You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Friday the 14th of July. Ko Jo Thomas Toko Ingoa, and I'm joined in studio today by my producer Kelly. Hi Kelly, how's it going?
Oh, it's going swell. So swell.
That's fantastic. So, we have several things on the show today. First, producer Kelly talked to Antarctic researcher Andrew McIntosh about the trillion-ton iceberg that has carved off the Antarctic Peninsula. Then we have our weekly chat with National MP Jamie Lee Ross, who Andrew Bailey is covering for. This is then followed by Radio Adelaide's Nicole Wedding and Neighbourhood Watch talking to us about the latest in Australian news. Finally, we have a study by the University of Auckland's Dr. Helen Pistosis Harris, who looks at the possibility of a gonorrhea vaccine. And then finally, producer Jack talks to Peter Griffin from the Science Media Centre and Dr. Doug Ashwell from Massey University about the state of science journalism. So stay tuned to hear all of that. And remember, if you have anything you'd like to add throughout the show, give us a text on 53395.
Yeah, boy.
So first up on the show, Kelly talked to Andrew McIntosh, the director of the Antarctic Research Centre, who gave some context to the trillion-ton iceberg that has just broken off the Larsen Sea ice shelf in the Antarctic Peninsula and is now adrift in the Weddell Sea. She asked them about how the break was detected and what this means for the ice shelf that has been left behind.
It's a very large iceberg, as everybody knows. People in the media have been quoting it as being about six times the size of Auckland. That's the Greater Auckland region, roughly the size of any big city like Melbourne or Auckland or something like that.
Because obviously you've got the satellites, and it says that there was two different NASA satellites that kind of recorded that it had broken off. Is that right? It's just detected by monitoring of Antarctic Peninsula?
Yeah, that's right, and it's been really fascinating because people have been observing the propagation of this crack, the sort of rift that's eventually resulted in this iceberg breaking off. They've been watching it day by day, sort of wondering when it was going to happen, and it's been really accelerating over the last few months. So it's kept glaciologists very busy.
So obviously the technology that you've got at the moment is pretty powerful and can see, you know, the satellites can see what's going on. Is this sort of the first time that you've had this technology and an iceberg this big is broken off?
It's rare. So there have only been a number of, just a handful of big icebergs that have broken off like that during the satellite observation era. I think only about three or four. This is one of the biggest. It's not the biggest. The largest was an iceberg called B15 that broke off the Ross Ice Shelf in the year 2000. It was twice as big as this particular iceberg, still observed by satellites at the time.
It's quite hard for you to speculate. Well, you know, what do you think will happen with this berg that's just kind of broken off?
Typically when a large iceberg like this breaks off, it will eventually break into a number of smaller pieces, and they tend to stick around the Antarctic coastline for a few years, kind of causing havoc, smashing into the coastline, in some cases perhaps crashing into other glaciers. They can scrape the bottom of the ocean floor and remove all of the marine life there, leaving great big sort of scar marks on the floor of the ocean. They can disrupt things like penguin colonies and make it harder for the penguins to find their homes. Depending on where they end up, they can affect shipping. This particular iceberg is likely to travel along the edge of the Antarctic Peninsula and eventually head northwards, sort of towards South America. It's likely to end up in the area around South Georgia or the Falkland Islands. Sometimes it can take years or even decades for this ice to melt away.
I have to ask as well, is there a relationship to climate change here, or is this just the natural flow of the Antarctic ice shelf?
I mean, there's a bit of a nuanced answer to that. So to begin with, I would say in this particular case, Most of this is a natural process, so it's the natural way that an ice shelf will lose mass from time to time.
Mm.
And we think that these big icebergs have been breaking off Antarctic ice shelves as long as there's, you know, as long as there's been an Antarctic ice sheet. And we've observed these things coming off well before the very dramatic effects of human-induced climate change have become apparent in the last 30 years. But what's sort of interesting about this particular ice shelf breakup is that it's in a part of Antarctica where the climate has been changing rather rapidly. And just to the north of it, the Larsen B ice shelf catastrophically broke up in one summer. And we could see in that case it was due to surface melting and the formation of water, sort of ponds on the surface of the ice shelf that led to its breakup.
Right.
Now, that's not the case for Larsen C. It's just been a big rift that's propagated. So we haven't seen any of those kind of, you know, warning signs that it's about melting yet. But it's a big, interesting natural experiment, and over the next few years, there's a chance that that loss of an iceberg might influence the stability of the ice shelf that's left behind. And in the case of Larsen B, for example, it actually did lose a big iceberg about 7 years before it eventually broke up. We're not sure what the relationship is between those two events exactly, but you can see what I'm getting at here.
Yeah,
Not directly, but in a complicated Earth system like this, I think you'd have to be very cavalier just to say there's absolutely no relationship, there could be some sort of indirect relationship.
Mm.
But ice shelves hold back the ice that sits on the continent behind, and so once you lose an ice shelf completely, you tend to have much larger amounts of faster flowing ice from the continent out to the sea, which then increases sea level through time.
Right.
So in fact, the loss of ice, we see the loss of ice shelves as being a sort of precursor to some of the more, you know, damaging effects that might occur and cause sea level rise in the future.
So that was Andrew McIntosh, the director of the Antarctic Research Centre. I then have a small excerpt of an interview with Nancy Bertler that reporter Laura Quigstad did. Nancy is an associate professor with the Antarctic Research Centre, who explains more to us just about the causes and the implications of the iceberg currently being adrift in the sea.
There's really sort of a range of possibilities. The first one is that it's a completely natural event, that it just occurred because icebergs always occur as, you know, the ice flows off the Antarctic continent into a shelf. At some point that ice needs to be removed, and it removes mainly through two processes, either through iceberg calving or through melting from underneath from the oceans. And so this could be just a very unusual large event that just happens from time to time. However, the Larsen C ice shelf is sort of in a really interesting space because it's part of the Antarctic Peninsula, which is the warmest, the fastest warming region on the planet. And further north of Larsen C, we have seen the Larsen B ice shelf catastrophically collapse in 2002, and also other ice shelves on the Antarctic Peninsula have cracked and reduced and thinned and collapsed. And that trend across all these ice shelves we can link very confidently with the increase in temperature both in the atmosphere and the ocean in the Antarctic Peninsula. And so this warming has slightly, or steadily rather, sort of migrated southwards. And the Larsen C ice shelf lies south of the Larsen B ice shelf. And so it's completely consistent that we would anticipate that the Larsen C ice shelf, in response to warming, would become unstable. So this iceberg, even so, you know, it's a single event, so we can't tell from a single event whether it's linked to a trend or not. But it could be the beginning of the destabilization of the ice shelf. And we won't know that until a few weeks or months from now, as we observe how the ice shelf responds now to having lost that iceberg, if it just regrows, or if we actually are seeing that there has been significant thinning and the ice shelf will sort of react faster and begins to disintegrate.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
That was Kelly Enright's report on a trillion-ton iceberg which broke off in the Antarctic Sea. After the break, we have a chat with National MP Andrew Bailey, who is covering for Jamie Lee Ross today.
The Hard Fast and Heavy Show on 95 BFM with the Whammy Crew every Sunday night from 11 p.m. till 1 a.m. God damn it!
Do you ever think about space? How it's just, you know, so unknowable and awesome?
Yeah, I guess so. I get confused about what's still a planet.
I know, right? And the stars. The insignificance of us.
Yeah. Hey, look, speaking of space, I'm the only person on this bus, right? You don't need to sit right here on my lap.
Sorry, I was just thinking about the cold, unknowable void.
Spaced Out. Spaced Out. Tune in to Saturday Morning Radio with Alice as she talks everything spacey with David Britton from Auckland's Star Dome Observatory and Planetarium. Spaced Out. Spaced Out. Saturday mornings on 95 BFM.
It's time for our weekly political chat with the National Party's Jamie Lee Ross.
Are you there, Andrew? How's it going?
Oh, very good, Joel.
Great. So we're joined on air right now by National Party's Andrew Bailey, who is covering for Jamie Lee Ross. So today we're going to talk about Labour's recently announced family package. So this week, Labour announced their family package, which eliminates the tax cuts proposed by National and will invest $900 million a year saved from reducing the tax cuts and putting it into reducing inequality, which Labour claims will be better off for 70% of families than National package. This obviously shows that Labour doesn't support tax cuts as much as National. Why do you think tax cuts will help low-income families instead of using that money to invest more in programs, welfare programs that will help the families?
So, Joel, the thing about tax cuts is that everyone benefits from them. So from the two tax cuts that we propose meant that anyone earning up to 14,000 they would only pay a tax rate of 10.5%. Now, what we've done is push that out to 22,000. That means anyone earning any money in New Zealand will pay the lower rate of tax up to 22,000. And in terms of the next band, we've increased that from 48 to 52,000. So it just means if you work, which of course everyone wants people working in New Zealand, if you work, you get the direct benefit from that.
Mm-hmm. So our research suggests that Nationals tax cuts would lead to the top 10% of earners saving $400 million a year, which is as much as the bottom 60% combined. And with as many as 295,000 children living in poverty and with homelessness on the rise, with over 1 in 100 New Zealanders homeless, wouldn't it be better to focus on helping out the poor in this dire state rather than giving that money to the rich, though?
What we're trying to do is actually benefit everyone, but particularly vulnerable families. And so if you are working, you will directly benefit from that. So that's the centrepiece of the tax reform around income tax. We've also made, as you know, quite significant changes around working for family and the accommodation supplements. And those both will help those vulnerable families in terms of that, in terms of providing them with greater financial support. But I think you've got to look at what we've done. We've got a pretty simple approach to it. New Zealand has a tax system that's the envy of the world in terms of its simplicity. And so that's centered around four rates of personal tax rates, and then we've got the accommodation supplement, and then we've got the working for families. What people don't understand, I'm sure your listeners won't understand, is the working for families package is a very complicated package. It's not a high-level thing you can just talk about easily. What we've tried to do is simplify it, but at the same time increase rates and payments to those vulnerable families where necessary.
Yes, so National has raised their working for families welfare payments under their proposed scheme, but Labor is raising the income eligibility threshold from an income of $35,000 to $42,000, which makes the scheme more accessible to an estimated 30,000 family, which shows more can be done to help those in need instead of just giving $400 million a year to the top 10% of earners. Don't you think that shows that more can be done?
Yeah, but I think you're only giving one side of the story, Joel. You've got to take it in totality. So certainly we've increased the working for family package. We've also increased the accommodation supplements. But at the same time, we've given people a decrease in tax that they'll effectively pay on the income. So when you've got to look at the whole package. You can't just slice parts off and say, well, that's more generous or that's less so. Overall, you've got to look at the package and say, what does that end up with? And we want to try and get a simpler system, and we also want to make sure that when people work, that they get a full benefit of that. And at the moment, we've got the highest number of New Zealanders at work. And so for all those 67% of people in New Zealand who work now between the working age of 18 through to 65, they will directly benefit from that. But at the same time, we're very conscious about vulnerable families, and that's why there's been some specific changes to improve their financial position.
Sure. So you did mention that that Labor's policy was slightly more complicated than just reducing tax, and the Child Poverty Action Group did actually claim that the package was quite complicated as well, which was disputed by Jacinda Ardern, but they also admitted that it was more generous than National's policy. So surely a complicated plan is better than a less helpful plan.
What won't know about is the difficulty in terms of calculating this. This is really, really complicated. In fact, we in Labor have gone to, they've introduced a number of new elements to their package on an already very complicated working for families package. So they've reinstated an independent earners tax credit, they've introduced a best start payment, they've dealt with abatement thresholds. Now, most people wouldn't know what all that meant, and it's very complicated to actually work out. And for many people, they find it difficult. I have people coming into my office, my electoral office, asking about their tax position because they find it difficult to understand it. So what we're trying to do is make this system much clearer so that people are fully aware of what they're entitled to and get paid for that. And that's been a central core of what some of these changes are about, is simplifying the tax system so everyone can understand it, but at the same time looking after the vulnerable families.
But raising the amount of money that people in the top 10% of tax earners would receive, so $400 million a year, is not necessarily helping the lower income families, is it?
So this is what people don't understand. For the lower income families, if you're a family on 50 odd thousand with three children, with the Working for Families, it effectively means that whilst you will be paying tax on your income, by the time you take into account the tax changes and the Working for Family package, most families don't pay any tax until they get to the a wage of roughly about $70,000, $75,000. Because all the tax is taken from the income, it's reimbursed through the Working for Families. The top 7% of earners in New Zealand basically pay about 35% of all New Zealand's tax. And so most of the tax in New Zealand actually gets generated by those top earners, and also from GST and company tax. So what we're dealing with here is that for the more vulnerable families, the people who are not earning the median wage, they're in a situation where basically they are well supported financially. And so to keep saying that the top percentage is going to get a huge tax benefit from that, from this tax change, is actually wrong, because at the moment they're paying a large slice of the tax anyway.
Sure, they are paying a large slice, but by reducing the amount of tax that they pay is not going to help the lower income families, is it?
Well, I think you've got to look at different groups. You know, with the vulnerable families, everyone's very conscious, and National's been very conscious. Most people forget that in last year's budget, if I said to you, what did we put up last year and spend most of our spare cash on in last year's budget, I'm not sure you'd be able to answer the question. But last year, we spent $880 million on increasing the benefits for people by $25 per week. It was the first real increase in benefits in 45 years. So last year's budget was all about people on benefits, and that was nearly $1 billion. This year we've got a $2 billion package, which is about further helping those vulnerable families. Together, it's a $3 billion package in terms of making sure that our vulnerable people are well looked after and have increasing financial security. So I think you've just got to look in that context. At the same time, we're trying to grow the economy and give people an incentive to work. And it means for all those large number of New Zealanders who are working, they get a direct benefit because their tax has gone down, their income tax has gone down.
Sure, but 70% more families will be better off under Labor's plan, which does not cut taxes for the top 10%.
Yeah, I don't know whether that figure's right or wrong, Joel, because what I do know is under National's budget that we put forward just recently, 1.3 million families will be better off. And those are principally the vulnerable families. Also, we've got 41,000 students who are going to be better off because they've got a higher amount of accommodation supplement. They're each going to get $20 per week. And 750,000 super annuitants are going to benefit, because they're going to be paying lower tax, and they've got the other associated tax changes that will as part of the package. So there's a huge number of New Zealanders who will be better off, and that's the way it should be. What we're trying to do is start to distribute the benefits of a growing economy.
Cool. Sweet. Thank you so much, Andrew Bailey, for coming on air today. That's all the time we have today. I hope you have a wonderful day, though.
Thank you very much, Joel. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too.
That was the National Party's Jamie Lee Ross.
Saturday afternoon emptiness. I feel dead inside.
Didn't that smashed avocado brunch help? That sneaky little yum cha we squeezed in?
Not really. This morning's not a country and tonight's just too far away. How are we going to make it through the in-between zone with our sanity intact?
I know. Let's turn on the BFM and send some psycho text to Sarah on the Saturday 2 to 4.
Aha, sanity saved.
The Saturday afternoon 2 till 4 with Sarah. Guaranteed good talk. text derailments, passing trivia, and songs to match. Saturday afternoons with Sarah from 2 p.m. on 95BFM.
Bye, Mum. I'm taking a boat over to K Road.
Okay, dear. Have you got your lead hat?
Yes.
Is your enviro suit all sealed up?
Yes, Mum.
Have you de-pooed some drinking water?
Mostly.
Okay, and be careful. The man who delivers the food paste says there's still some frothing climate change deniers in the water over Grafton Gully. Oh, and son?
Yes?
We might be home late. Your father and I are being sent back in time to rescue Lily Peacock and save the planet from climate disaster.
Hooray! Alternate future. Wait, will I still be born?
Want a better future for the planet? Listen into The Green Desk with Lily Peacock every Tuesday on The Wire on 95BFM. Thanks to the Monaco Beautification Charitable Trust.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wives. Wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
Great. So we are joined with Nicole Wedding from Radio Adelaide. How's it going, Nicole?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Not so bad, thanks. So first up on our list, we have Australians. They are calling for a space program. Why is Australia in the right position to do this at the moment?
Yeah, so as you said, yeah, Australia is calling for a space program. Industry Minister Arthur Sinodinos announced that the federal government was looking to establish a space agency. And it looks like it's basically about the right time for us to follow suit. Most developed nations have one, including New Zealand. I read that you announced one last year. And the global space industry's revenue is growing. It's more than $422 billion annually, and the sector has been growing by about 10% each year since the late 90s. So we have already had quite a bit of involvement in national and international space activities, but by having a dedicated agency, we could basically have a more cohesive space program and provide a stronger platform for collaboration. So we could oversee the launch of satellites for communication and navigation. And of course, you know, a space agency's main role would be to help keep jobs here and $3 billion of spending in Australia rather than flying overseas. So it'll be interesting to see if we do get one. I know that in a geographical sense, like, we're in a good position for one. And an expert panel will lead the review and report by the end of March next year.
So is there sort of a consensus among the government that it is a good idea, or is there some sort of debate going on about it at the moment?
Yeah, there's a little bit of debate going on about it. I know that the opposition was saying that, you know, it's a bit late for the government to be saying this, and they're not really committing to action. They're just, you know, supporting this expert panel, looking into doing a review. So it's interesting, but it looks like the economics of it seems to make sense. Everything that I read said that it was a space agency would be good, undoubtedly, for the economy. So you'd think that the government would want to do it. So we'll see.
Yeah, cool. So moving on, South Australia is about to become home to the biggest lithium-ion battery in the world. Can you tell me a bit about why this is and what the history is behind this decision?
Yeah, sure. So last year, South Australia went through this really big blackout. It made national news, and yeah, the state's electricity just became a talking point for the nation. And so as a result of this, the CEO of Tesla, Elon Musk, made Australia an offer that his company would solve South Australia's energy issues within 100 days, or the entire job would be free. So since then, it seems the South Australian government has been sitting on this information for a while, but this week it was officially announced that Tesla will build the world's largest lithium-ion battery in South Australia. So this battery is 100 megawatts and it'll store energy from a French company-owned wind farm, which is still under construction, but it's set to become the largest generator of renewable energy in the state. So while the battery won't provide the state with any more power than it has, it will provide stability to the system and will be used as a backup power system if there's a shortfall. So if all goes to plan, Musk says it'll be up and running before summer, and it's a project going to be worth up to $50 million. So both Musk and the Australian government have a lot riding on this.
Great. And finally, new research has proven exposing the endangered bettong to the wild will increase its chances of survival. Where has this research come from?
Yeah, so another South Australian story. These bittongs are these tiny marsupials in South Australia's arid lands. And, yeah, as you said, they're apparently adapting to life alongside their predators, which are feral foxes and cats. So it is a good news story. They're a threatened animal and only usually found on islands or inside fenced reserves. So the fact that they're adapting is, yeah, big news for environmentalists and researchers. Scientists working at the Arid Recovery Reserve near Roxby Downs observed more than 200 of these endangered burrowing bittongs outside the fenced-off reserve last month. And they were really surprised because, you know, there were all these feral cats there. And they'd actually been changing already. They changed physically by getting longer feet to presumably run away from the predators. And they'd become more aggressive. So numbers were actually increasing out there compared to inside the fenced area, which they were just shocked by. So there's a lot of renewed hope they might eventually be able to come off the endangered list.
Cool. Can you tell me a bit more about the bittong? Because I only know that they're extremely cute, and that's all I've seen from the picture of them as a New Zealander that's never really heard much about them.
I mean, that's pretty much, that's all I know about them, really. They're really cute, and they're traditionally not an aggressive animal. They're kind of a very mellow animal. So hearing these changes is kind of interesting. I mean, I guess it's kind of looks similar to a bilby, I guess.
Okay.
But yeah, that's all I know. They're cute, and they were very threatened. And I think maybe we were overcompensating and thinking they couldn't deal with the environment they were in.
Cool. Sweet. Well, thank you so much, Nicole, for coming on air today.
No
it was
worries.
Great to talk to you as usual, and I'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, speak to you then.
Sweet.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
So that was Nicole Whitting from Neighbourhood Watch. And up next, we have a report on gonorrhea by our producer, Jack.
Wire. Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
So, with over 78 million cases of gonorrhea every year, STIs are one of the world's largest silent diseases hitting the world. This makes a study by Dr. Helen Pistosis-Harris all more important, with a hope for a vaccine in the pipeline. Producer Jack spoke to Dr. Pistosis Harris about what her team study has found.
We discovered that the vaccine that was used in about a million New Zealanders under the age of 20 against meningococcal disease has also provided some cross-protection against gonorrhea.
So what are we going to do with this information, or how can we use this?
Well, that's a good question. How do we use this information, especially given that that vaccine is now no longer made? I guess two things. One is that it is it gives us some information as to what might what will offer protection against gonorrhea, which nobody had before. We were all sort of a bit clueless on that front because having gonorrhea doesn't protect you against getting gonorrhea. So there's a whole lot of research that needs to be done to understand that. The other thing is that we have a couple of vaccines available on the global market that are being used now, being used reasonably extensively. One in particular has the New Zealand ingredient, the ingredient from our New Zealand vaccine in it. So, of course, it's expected that you might see the same effect in these vaccines, and that needs to be tested as well.
As much as we like in the kind of like the news or the world, we'd love to think that, you know, now we've just made this discovery and we've cured gonorrhea, but it's more like this is one kind of piece of the puzzle towards eventually finding some kind of vaccine.
Well, yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, you know, the effect that we've seen is not what you would consider a flash vaccine by any means, but the reason that we're having the conversation in the first place is because Cuba and New Zealand, who both use these type of vaccines, it's a very observable decline in gonorrhea almost immediately after we started using the vaccines. So you can go onto the surveillance data from these countries and you just see this great sudden dip. Now, Cuba kept using their vaccine and gonorrhea basically, it's not a problem there anymore. It sort of disappeared. New Zealand stopped, and then the rates picked up again. So, and modelling supports that if you have a vaccine that isn't super effective, it can still have a really significant public health effect. So I guess, given we have meningococcal vaccines that may have the same effect, there could be a place for them while people beaver away, making a much more effective gonorrhea vaccine, because it could make quite a difference just by using what we have now.
And just touching on Cuba and, was it Norway as well?
Yeah.
What was the difference between the New Zealand kind of case study and those that actually kind of made the difference, or made the paper kind of more newsworthy and more credible?
Well, that really is the eyeball there, surveillance data, the same as we did at the beginning. There was no study. There was just hypotheses there. So what we did was test the hypotheses and positive results. So it wasn't able to be proven before. We were the only people that could actually do a study.
All right. And so from here, what the next steps are, just kind of maybe implementing this in the kind of global, or at least New Zealand kind of wider context, or ideally if we can get the politicians to do it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, because, for example, the UK has one of these vaccines on their infant schedule. They've just introduced it to all their infants. So what they're, you know, busy thinking about at the moment is, well, what would happen if we introduced it to adolescents as well? And of course, in terms of meningococcal disease, that's an issue for adolescents as well. So would we get a double whammy if we did this? So I think you find that they're considering that at the moment, and perhaps other countries thinking of introducing these vaccines to the infants may think about adolescents as well. We have to see, but that would be a possibility.
So around, you know, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit. The Wire.
So that was producer Jack speaking to Dr. Helen Pistosis-Harris about her breakthrough in vaccinating gonorrhea. Up next, we have a story about the state of science journalism and the ever-competitive and changing media landscape. Thank you for all your texts in. Please, if you want to add anything to the show, please text into 5395. We've had some great contributions so far.
Wake me up before you go to the other side of the world that we all know. Lazy, hazy, beautiful.
Your skin, I'm your mind.
So that track was called Orange Colour Queen by Ty Segall. Up next we have Jack's report on the state of science journalism.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
With media mergers and restructures constantly shrinking funding for quality journalism, 95BFM reporter Jack Marshall spoke with Dr. Doug Ashwell, Associate Head of School of Communication, Journalism and Marketing, as well as Peter Griffin, the Director of Science Media Centre. First off, Jack asked Dr. Ashwell about the current state of science journalism in New Zealand.
There are some very, very good science journalists in New Zealand, and yet they're very few and far between. And some of the most experienced ones have actually left, either have retired out of the system, or they have moved on to other things. And so what often happens is that unless someone picks up that torch as such and becomes a dedicated science journalist, then you get younger people coming into the industry, and I'm not saying that they're not good journalists, but they just don't have the experience and in some cases the training to be able to carry that torch as well, and they might probably need a lot more experience as they go through. For example, there was a gentleman, Alan Sampson, who was on the Dominion Post, and he had been a journalist for some 30 years, probably a highly respected science journalist, and he's now retired and moved on. Karen Chugg was also working on the Dominion Post when I did that study. She was a young journalist doing very, very well, but then when I went to do a follow-up with her, she'd already gone and moved overseas. So what it is that it seems to be that science journalists don't stay in that job for very long and they move on quite quickly. And you lose that continuity. And this was some of the things that the PR people were also saying, is that they would get to know a journalist and start to have a working relationship with them. And no sooner they'd done that, then someone new would come in. And those someone new's don't always have the same background and they'd have to start again. And so I think it is the occupation of being a science journalist changes quite rapidly. People move in and out quite rapidly. But I also think there is now a lot of pressure from journalism per se in the fact, especially with newspapers, with the financial pressures they're under. And I would say it's the same for radio. Radio is very, very competitive. And TV's even competitive. And so with all those financial changes, sometimes science and science journalism kind of comes one of those things that you can easily lop off or kind of take people out of. And so you're left with a kind of vacuum which is filled by people who are more general journalists. And that can cause some issues for the various different groups.
And just to wrap it off, how do you see science journalism changing but right now, and also into the future?
I think more of it's going to go online, and that causes also other issues for journalists as to, if they're working solely online, that's fine, but one of the journalists I interviewed was working for print and also had to have stories for online, so it puts increasing pressure on journalists to write for multiple platforms. And yet I think, you know, that's probably what's going to be the major thing is a shift to the more online. And that has some advantages and may have some real benefits for what the public receive. Because with online journalism, as we know, you can put in more content. You can put in videos. You can put in photographs more than you can, say, for a newspaper article or for a radio broadcast. Television is still there and you can put things on television, but if we're talking about news as such, it's only a 10 to 20 second clip and that really doesn't do much. Where with online, you can put more content, make more content available, more hyperlinks to different things. So there could be some real advantages with that for the public to actually become more aware. And the thing is that my study was actually replicated in Australia last year. And for the Australians, they had different results where they found that science journalism was they had very, very positive things to say about science journalism in Australia. And so that was an interesting result. So it may be that if you have more resources put into the area, then you can have better results coming out the other side. And that may be where the Greens and that kind of move would be a good thing.
Yeah, I think it was actually one of the Google founders says it's kind of like a, they're just dollar problems. Like you, all it needs is more funding often rather than most other kind of complex ideas.
Yeah, it is and it isn't as well. I think it's funding and I think also a level of understanding not the science per se, as in, you know, the particular area of science, but more the scientific method. How do scientists actually go about doing their day-to-day work? Because very often science is reported as some kind of outstanding breakthrough or, you know, big study. And yesterday we heard that if I drink three cups of coffee, you and I will grow, you know, will live longer because we drink three cups of coffee a day, but they're not sure why. And that's one study, but has that study been replicated? You know, are they going to try and replicate it? What are they going to do with it? It's like we get one groundbreaking study that seems really interesting, so we publish it as a story, but how was the science done? What was done? How many people were involved? And those kind of details sometimes get cut out of the mix. And so we sometimes can end up with these kind of seemingly breakthrough discoveries, and then you don't hear about them for ages more because they can't be replicated or something along those lines. So I think it is about putting more funding into the sector, but also training people in the scientific method so that they know what is good science and what is not good science, or at least know how to ask the questions around those issues so that we don't suddenly get things published that are really not, they weren't good science in the first place. And the other thing is to be balanced, but not balanced in a way which takes anyone who has a different point of view and allows them to speak in a story. So for me, what I'm trying to say there is, for example, the climate change debate in the United States, at least, used to balance stories, and sometimes to balance stories, a journalist would go and look for anyone who had a counterpoint of view, and not necessarily were those scientific views, but those were opinions more or less.
Next up, I spoke to Peter Griffin from the Science Media Centre about what the organisation does, how it was founded, and its place in New Zealand journalism.
So we were set up in 2008 with funding from the government. We were set up by the Royal Society of New Zealand, which is sort of the Academy of Scientists and Researchers here in New Zealand. So a lot of the esteemed scientists in the country are fellows of the Royal Society. And both the government and the society saw a bit of a market failure in New Zealand in that we saw dwindling resources in newsrooms, particularly for coverage of science, health, environment, technology related issues. And if you think about sort of the massive change that's going on in the world that are driven by science and technology, it was pretty alarming to them that a lot of these issues weren't being covered particularly well. We don't have specialist science reporters in newsrooms anymore in New Zealand. We typically have younger generalist reporters who are covering complex issues like climate change or stem cell research or genetics or new cancer discoveries. So it's very hard for them to get know the context, to know how significant some of these developments are. So we were set up as a centre to help frontline journalists who are covering these issues gain access to experts and to peer-reviewed, evidence-based research papers. And we've been doing that. We do workshops in newsrooms to upskill those journalists who are covering science-related issues. And more recently, we've moved into media training of scientists as well with our Science Media Savvy program, and that's really to give scientists the confidence and skills to actually engage with the media, do interviews, talk to journalists, that sort of thing.
So we're seeing the scientific research become more commercialized, and at the same time we're seeing more competition in the media sector. So how do you kind of balance this like changing field every day?
Yeah, I think that's the crux of it, really. You're right in that I think the nature of science and research has become more commercialized. Partly that is driven by the, you know, the government urging the sector to pursue these partnerships. They have a real innovation agenda to raise research and development, and they quite rightly see the key to that being collaboration with the private sector. That's something that the U.S. research sector is built on, these great collaborations between the big science-based companies and the universities in the U.S., so that's been very successful. I think the downside of that is that with commercial sensitivity comes limitations on what scientists and experts can talk about, and we've definitely seen a bit of that in New Zealand, where a lot of the scientists we work with are reticent to talk too much about their science because it's commercially sensitive. They're working with clients in the private sector that are using that research. So that's an issue we're encountering. The bigger issue probably, though, is what you talked to about the changing media landscape, which is at the moment NZME and Fairfax still pursuing their merger proposal, but has already been rejected by the Commerce Commission, so it's unlikely to go any further. And we're seeing consolidation, as you point out, between Vodafone and Sky TV. Even though they haven't been able to merge, they're going to collaborate more closely. So we're seeing a lot of consolidation. We're seeing shrinking newsrooms, which is a concern for us because there's just less and less resource for specialist coverage about important issues that are science related. On the flip side of that, we're also seeing some new ventures emerging, the likes of the spin-off Newsroom, which has broken some big stories, including the Todd Barclay affair that they've been following. And we're seeing new ventures like The Conversation come into New Zealand as well, which is a platform for academics to write about their research, and then those stories are syndicated to lots of media outlets.
One kind of last point I would like to bring up with you is that the idea of independence within the Science Media Centre. So how do you maintain independence from, you know, the government and scientists and things like that? But so the instance I'm thinking of is I just did a story last week with MPI and, you know, the group of scientists that challenging this idea that New Zealand has some of the best fish stock management in the world. So how do you manage your independence when you've got, you know, government money coming in and, you know, science, like, conflicting?
Yeah, that's a good question because, you know, we're almost 100% funded by the government, by the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment. So all of our funding comes there. We have terms of reference that guarantee our editorial independence, and we have governance and oversight not only from an independent board of advisors but from the Royal Society. So so far, and we're about 2 days away from our ninth birthday, that's actually worked incredibly well, and we've had no government interference. They like what we do and haven't tried to sort of meddle in what we do. But that case around MPI and the fisheries, I think, is symbolic of the real issue that we face. And the problem with science in New Zealand is that often the most complex and controversial science, there's only a small handful of people doing it. So, for instance, when that report from Dr. Simmons came out from the University of Auckland about the state of New Zealand fisheries, it was very, very difficult for us to find any independent experts to provide commentary on that. And we did in the end. We were the only organization that did find some independent commentary. But too often in this country, you get a government department and maybe a Crown Research Institute that's providing services to a government department on one side, and then some sort of a small band of scientists questioning the consensus or the established view on the other side, and very few people in the middle who are willing to look at it all independently, declare the conflicts of interest, and provide some commentary that the media can use. That's where we see ourselves sitting, is in the middle, trying to find those independent voices, trying to prepare those scientists to engage. And that's what our Science Media Savvy program is about. Some scientists are just really scared of working with the media. They may have been burned in the past, or it's just too controversial a topic. But increasingly, as we have major issues that are science-related. For instance, you know, the pest-free initiative that the government has announced, a lot of scientists tell us that it will be hard to achieve those aims without looking at some sort of biological or even genetic solution to that. So suddenly we're in genetic modification territory again, which is quite controversial and not popular with the public. So we need people who can articulate these issues and who are independent as well in their outlook, so they don't have a vested interest, or if they do, they're willing to disclose that. So those people are going to be much more important and relevant to the discussion than ever in the coming years, and so we're well placed to actually support those people, tell those stories.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that was The Wire for Friday the 7th of June. Thank you for those who came on the show today. We had Andrew McIntosh and Nancy Bertler, Andrew Bailey. We also had Nicole Whitting, Peter Griffin, and Doug Ashwell. Thank you very much to our producers, Kelly and Jack, who did a great job today, News Director Shemina Smith. Up next, we have Land of the Good Groove of Murray. Hope you have a lovely afternoon, and I'll be back next week.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.